Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. When Donald Trump was elected president, Toni Morrison wrote this in The New Yorker, quote, "So scary are the consequences of a collapse of white privilege that many Americans have flocked to a political platform that supports and translates violence against the defenseless as strength. These people are not so much angry as terrified with the kind of terror that makes knees tremble. On Election Day, how eagerly so many white voters, both the poorly educated and the well-educated, embrace the shame and fear sowed by Donald Trump," unquote. Now, it may not have been surprising to hear Toni Morrison use the term white privilege then. It may have been more surprising yesterday when Joe Biden invoked white supremacy.
"We have a problem with this rising tide of supremacy, white supremacy in America. And we have a president who encourages and emboldens it. We're living through a rare moment in this nation's history where our president isn't up to the moment, where our president lacks the moral authority to lead, where our president has more in common with George Wallace than he does with George Washington."
So that was one time Biden said white supremacy out loud in a speech he gave yesterday. Here's another.
"This president has fanned the flames of white supremacy in this nation. His low energy, vacant-eyed mouthing of the words written for him, condemning white supremacists this week, I don't believe fooled anyone at home or abroad. His energetic embrace, the energetic embrace of this president by the darkest hearts and most hate-filled minds in this country say it all. When the white nationalist Richard Spencer celebrated Trump's election by declaring, 'Hail Trump,' at an alt-right conference where the Nazi salute was being used."
Joe Biden yesterday. Our first guest today reprinted that Toni Morrison quote in a piece in the Washington Post. It's Washington Post writer Eugene Scott. But before we bring him on, here's something else that he quoted in the Post. This observation from Princeton professor Eddie Glaude on Nicole Wallace's show on MSNBC.
"What we know is that the country has been playing politics for a long time on this hatred. We know this. So it's easy for us to place it all on Donald Trump's shoulders. It's easy for us to place Pittsburgh on his shoulders. It's easy for me to place Charlottesville on his shoulders. It's easy for us to place El Paso on his shoulders. This is us. And if we're going to get past this, we can't blame it on him. He's a manifestation of the ugliness that's in us. I've had the privilege of growing up in a tradition that didn't believe in the myths and the legends because we had to bear the brunt of them. Either we're going to change, Nicole, or we're going to do this again and again, and babies are going to have to grow up without mothers and fathers, uncles and aunts, friends, while we're trying to convince white folk to finally leave behind a history that will maybe, or embrace a history that might set them free from being white. Finally.
Eddie Glaude on MSNBC. So there's the Trump issue and the longer, deeper issue facing our country. With me now is Eugene Scott, who writes for the Washington Post's politics blog, The Fix. Thanks for coming on, Eugene. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
Can we start with a Toni Morrison quote and how sad that in her final years she had to see the country come to this, even in her final days, see the country come to what's happened in these final days? What have you been thinking about Toni Morrison these last few days since her death at this fraught time?
Oh, wow, so much. Specifically in relation to me and the work I do as a journalist, Toni Morrison was very vocal about unapologetically writing about race in America. I think a lot of times, especially earlier in my career, I was given the impression that having expertise or a perspective on race matters was not as impressive as perhaps being well-versed in economics or mastering Mandarin. But I think what this current political climate has taught us is that those covering politics really do need to have a history of that speaks to the story of race in this country and how racism shapes politics and policies currently. And people like her unapologetically in her positions of power and influence, be it in academia or publishing, paved the way for people like me to write about these things. And I'm so grateful for that. But to your initial question about how it's perhaps unfortunate that in the last years of Morrison's life, she saw America move in the direction that it had after, you know, she expressed so much joy in seeing Obama elected. She noted that it was one of the first times, if not the first time, that she truly felt patriotic. I think she was expressing the disappointment and frustrations of many Black Americans and, quite frankly, white Americans as well, who thought that the Obama administration was a pivot towards America becoming what the founders had hoped it would become, at least in word, if not in deed. I think she spent these last couple years perhaps not surprised by where things were going, but certainly saddened that the hope that Obama has written about repeatedly still remains unfulfilled.
Before Obama was elected, Bill Clinton had been called our first Black president, and it was Toni Morrison who said that. But you remind us in one of your posts that she didn't mean what most people might think in remembering Toni Morrison called Bill Clinton our first Black president, right?
Indeed, and I was really glad to discover that in my reporting, because I had not read the clarification before and was a bit uncomfortable with how that phrase, Bill Clinton being the first Black president, had been interpreted. And it was quite frankly a joy to read her say that she had been misinterpreted. And what I wrote about is that she felt like Clinton's political opponents had treated him the same way many conservatives have historically treated Black men in America, based on his personal narratives and identities. She thought that he was the first president to be treated like a Black man, opposed to a white man, which is what, up until that point, all presidents had been.
So for people who thought it was because he played the saxophone on the Arsenio Hall show, it wasn't that.
I certainly was one of those who thought it was that initially, but that's why it's really important to read things in context.
What about the Eddie Glaude clip? From an anti-racist perspective, I think it's fair to say there's this sort of national emergency right now around Trump and his constant provocations. Is now the time to focus on the deeper racism of American history and consciousness?
Well, for people like Professor Glaude, who is by definition an academic, these aren't mutually exclusive conversations. It's impossible to talk about the racism that many Americans believe is coming from Trump without talking about the history of racism in America. And I think what he was speaking to was a frustration that many people who just have even a surface level of American history are feeling any time we hear someone, regardless of how well-intended, say, this isn't who we are. When the truth is, this is very much who we are. This racism is so fundamental to the American story, and at the highest levels of government and in policy, and next door to us and in our schools and in our churches and other places we do life. And so I think what Glaw wanted to do, as he communicated, is really take the pivot off of Trump, stop centering him so much, and have some real conversations about us and where we came from. And I think that's so important, because if Americans really make up their mind that what we're seeing right now is unique to Trump, they're going to be in for a rude awakening when Trump does eventually leave the Oval Office and we're still dealing with these very real race issues.
Do you understand what Dr. Glaude means there by getting past being white? At the end of the excerpt that we played, he was talking about white people. He hopes at some point we'll finally get past being white, because on one level it's just a skin color, right? And it's right. You know, really privilege or entitlement or supremacy that we have to get past, not being white, which is just a pigment.
Indeed, I think his point was that, and those unfamiliar with him, he chairs the African American Studies Department at Princeton, so deals with racial matters quite a bit. Race is a social construct. And so what it means to be white, what it means to be white in America, is something that has been made up. And white supremacy is a myth. It is a lie. The idea that white people are superior to people who are not white, is just something that is not true. And I think Glaude was talking to the frustration and anger and anxiety that many white Americans who are clinging to a vision of America from the past currently feel, as they feel that they are losing some of what it means to be a white American. I think when you look at some of the data, there's some good analysis from PRRI and The Atlantic about white Americans just feeling like maybe the advantage or the status or place that they have in this country is not as advanced or ahead or secure as it used to be. And I think Glaude was saying, let's reexamine why you held so much faith in that status in the first place.
And with Eugene Scott from The Washington Post, here's one more clip from Biden's speech yesterday.
After Trump tweeted his go back screed, a leading neo-Nazi website said, "This is the kind of nationalism we elected him for." He knows it. He saw it.
And earlier we played the two clips of Biden saying the term white supremacy in connection with Trump from that speech yesterday. Is it unusual, Eugene, for Joe Biden to talk about white supremacy?
Yes. I mean, we are in a unusual time. It's certainly not unheard of. And we know that Biden had to address conversations related to race during the presidency of the first black president, the actual first black president, which Biden served in, obviously, but not to the degree that we currently have seen him address. I think one thing that's just so notable about this campaign, regardless of what happens, is that Biden launched his presidential campaign criticizing Trump's handling of the Charlottesville riots. And so I think whatever happens, especially if he heads to the White House officially, when it's all said and done, I think speaking about white supremacy will have to be a core piece of Biden's administration, because it very much is a national problem, especially if you look at polling and see what Americans think.
How do you explain, as a political analyst, Biden consistently in the polls being the dominant leader among black Democrats, with his history of opposition to integration and his writing the crime bill in the 90s that came to be associated so much with mass incarceration and not apologizing for it, and the Anita Hill hearings and other things that he not just supported but led on?
I have a few thoughts. So one, it really is early, and people are engaged more than they normally would be in a election, but no one is engaged as much as, you know, the pundit class. And I think there is still a lack of knowledge about who all is running and what they stand for. And Joe Biden is a familiar name to many Americans, especially Black Americans, in part because of his association with Obama. It's my belief that many voters are more aware of Joe Biden as a vice president than they are as a Delaware senator putting forward some questionable policy ideas, or even as a senator overhearing the Anita Hill hearings. And so despite the reporting that's been done about those things, I've written quite extensively about them both. I'm not sure many Americans know that part of Biden. And even some of the ones who do, I think, still believe that Joe Biden is the candidate most likely to beat Trump because of his ability to win support from Black Americans, specifically older Black Americans who have consistently high turnout rates when it comes to voting compared to younger Black Americans who are very politically active and engaged, but maybe not always voting. And his ability to win white working class professionals, I'm sorry, not professionals, white professionals and white working class voters, and bring this coalition together to defeat Trump. And so I think that's why so many people are behind his campaign.
It's a pretty unusual coalition in today's politics, right? Black voters.
Indeed.
And I get it's particularly older Black voters. I think Biden is not the leading candidate among younger Black voters. But yes, but the largest group of Black voters and white working class voters. So listeners will take calls later in the program with your eulogies for Toni Morrison today and some of your favorite Toni Morrison quotes. But for now, what do you want to say or what do you want to ask Eugene Scott 5 days after El Paso and Dayton? If you're a Black Joe Biden supporter, call and tell us why, or any supporter of anyone else, as the best way to deal with these issues. On the Eddie Glaude clip of not focusing too much on Trump as opposed to the deeper roots of all these things, or anything else, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. That we're talking about with Eugene Scott, who writes for the Washington Post's political blog, The Fix. Let me stay on the presidential politics for a minute, meaning the Democratic primary politics. In the new Q poll, after the two rounds of debates, Biden, for all the hits he took from so many candidates, prominently Kamala Harris on integration, of course, and in the second debate from everyone else, it seemed, like Gillibrand on his opposition in writing way back when to daycare 40 years ago and both parents working outside the home. That's kind of shocking to read today. Despite all of those attacks, Biden held about steady with a whopping third of the vote. Gillibrand remained around zero. Kamala Harris dropped 5 points. Only Elizabeth Warren, who did not really attack other candidates, now she was not matched up with Biden in either of the debates, but nevertheless, she wasn't in that position. She is the only one really who went up from before. It's just one poll, but it seems to say that when it comes to Biden or those who criticize his past record, even accurately, nothing matters. What do you take from it?
I think my main takeaway is that debates at this stage in the campaign do not have as much power as the political class believes they do. I think I saw yesterday that the ratings for the second night of the debate, which is the night that Kamala Harris was in, only got like 2 million viewers. I think the first night got 4 million viewers. And, you know, those of us who were in the office until 1 a.m., I thought everyone was up till 1 a.m. watching this debate. And I just don't think that is true. And I found that to be the case when talking to people, you know, outside of Washington or inside of D.C., but outside of the bubble. And I think people are waiting a while before they really devote their entire attention to the debate. But I do think those who were paying attention maybe did not see, you know, from some of the candidates who really needed a boost, anything that led them to walk away from the one they brought, which is Biden.
Let's take a phone call. Zora in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hello, Zora.
Yes. Hello. How are you? Thank you.
Thank you.
So what I wanted to say is that You know, as I'm African American, I have a young daughter who's going to be a sophomore this year at UPenn. And just last night, she and I were having a conversation. She was elected to be the diversity chair of her sorority. And, you know, it was asking her, you know, what are you going to say to your fellow sisters, to sorority members who are predominantly, you know, white young women? Do you temper what you say to them because you feel that, you know, you have to do that so that you're not offending people or being thought of in certain positions? And, you know, her response was just very interesting. But anyway, I don't want, you know, long story short, you know, it's not our, as black people, we're often burdened with, especially young people, like we're burdened with having to accept, you know, someone else's inferiority about how they feel about us. And I tried to tell her, it's not your burden to carry. If someone cannot accept you because of the pigment of your skin, not your character, not your personality, just because of the pigment of your skin, that's not your burden to carry. You are someone who is a great person, and you just need to be yourself and enjoy your life and enjoy the world. It belongs to all of us. And what I wanted to say about the discussion today is that white people, every single one of them, need to understand that they're all benefiting from white privilege. Even if you're a liberal, even if you don't support Trump, even if you hate what he's doing, even if you hate what this country has done, and until they renounce that and say, this is not right, look where I live, and look what I have, and look what these other people don't have, and why is that the case, and it's not fair and it's not right, then no matter what we do, it, nothing is going to change, because there are always going to be people who hate. There are always going to be people who identify that I'm this way, and this is, you're another person, and so I can't relate with you. But if the majority of white people denounce this white privilege and say that it's not right, that's where change is going to happen. We can sit down and talk about it all day long, but, you know, there was a quote from A Raisin in the Sun where, you know, one of the white characters, when the black people wanted to move into the area, and they did, and he said, well, you know, you may be able to be here legally or something of the sort. I may not be getting it quite right. Mm-hmm. But until you change people's hearts, you know, nothing is going to change. You can change the law, but until you change people's hearts. So, I mean, I would like to say to President Trump, who, like the professor from Princeton said, is just a reflection, is just a symptom of the infrastructure of America and our history for all these years, is that, you know, don't attack him, because, you know, we know who he is. Once you attack him, he's just going to fight back, just like all the other people. Don't attack them. Try to get to their heart. Like, what is it about you that's making you feel this way? Let's examine you. Stop examining me as a black person, because I'm not the problem. Let's examine you. Why do you feel this way? And what can we do about it to enlighten you and change your mind and make you see that we're all the same? And, you know, even if we're not all the same, I don't want to be a cliche, but it's not so deep that you shouldn't be able to accept me, and you shouldn't want to burden me with your inferiority, because frankly, that's what it is. You're afraid. You're afraid of us, and you need to stop it, because we're not here to take anything away. We're just trying to live just like people, and I want to be unburdened. I want my children to be unburdened. Yesterday, you had on your show a topic about, you know, gun violence in black communities, and the reason why black kids are running around killing each other is because they don't feel any love. There's no love. We, you know, so we internalize that, and we end up hating each other. It's all a symptom of not feeling that we're loved in this country, not feeling that we're valued. In this world, you can go anywhere in the world. I'm planning a trip to Japan, and I was talking to my daughter again last night, and she said, you know, in Japan, you know, they're so, not just Japan, but other countries as well, they're so racist against black people. And, you know, here we have to have a conversation about that. Why? Because the U.S. has spread this view about us in the world that we're just bad people. So you can go behind a rock somewhere, and you're going to get treated badly as a black person. Yeah. So you don't even feel comfortable to go about in the world, because you have to be afraid of what you're going to experience when you get there. And, I mean, it's just not right. And I, as a black person, I want to be unburdened
and Zora,
by somebody else's inferiority.
Yes. And what you say about white people needing to look at themselves, I'm sure I don't have to tell you this, but that's exactly what Toni Morrison's writing was about to a large degree, writing about the black experience, not through the quote white gaze, as she put it. That's why when racial studies on college campuses really started a number of decades ago, It was Black Studies. Now there's White Studies. And that's right. That's how Professor Glaude used the term white or whiteness in that quote, which at first, because I know because I experienced it at one point as a white person, it's it's a little shocking for white people to hear. What? White studies? Explore our own whiteness, explore our own assumptions, explore our own gaze. And so that all ties together, like you say. And I'm curious for you, Zora, if you're at all encouraged in the context of all of that by hearing someone as often cautious in his politics as Joe Biden is, to come out and say white supremacy explicitly like he did in his speech yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely a step in the right direction because it's reality. But I just hope that it's not sort of, oh, well, this is the tide now and this is the moment. So I'm just going to say this. You know, it's not just words. It's like, again, the heart of the matter. Is that really your heart? Is that really what you believe now? Because obviously we know his past is not necessarily that. And yes, people can change. And I hope you change. And I hope you learn, because that's what it's all about. So as long as it's sincere and his actions are going to align with his words, then yes, absolutely. It's definitely a good thing and a positive thing.
Zora, thank you so much for your call. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, first, Eugene Scott from The Washington Post. That was a long call. So if there was anything you were thinking about during our exchange, you could say it.
Yeah, I think the point about the reality that individuals benefit from privilege, whether or not they feel like it or acknowledge it, it's really important. I think when we look at a very important conversation that's existing in our political debate right now about income inequality and the wealth gap, you can't talk about the racial wealth gap without talking about racism and even without talking about slavery and Jim Crow. And so it's been really interesting seeing just for decades, I guess, policymakers trying to solve very real problems in America that are linked to race without talking about race, which is difficult, if not impossible. And I think this current presidential election, in part, you know, because it follows the election of Obama and the election of Trump, we're seeing people, some on both sides of the aisle say we cannot avoid conversations about race anymore.
Here are a couple of questions from listeners via Twitter. One asks, since I referred to the fact, and I think I got this right, maybe you know the exact stats. I referred to Biden being the leading candidate so far in the polls among older Black Americans or Black likely Democratic primary voters, but not among youngers. And so listener writes, who is the leading Democratic candidate among young Black voters? Do you happen to know? Because I don't.
That's a great question. And so we have not seen any polling specifically look at millennials yet. And we know that millennials will be the largest voting bloc in 2020, surpassing baby boomers. But the reason why many people analyzing these polls believe that the support for Biden and for everyone, quite frankly, is primarily coming from older Black voters is because when you look at when you dig into the polls and you see the ages of who was polled overall, younger Americans are not well represented.
Right. And I know that I've heard analysts who, you know, are mainstream analysts without an agenda who are looking at the polls make that demographic split by age, Biden, no Biden, or that is Biden versus somebody else. And I don't have the exact answer, so we will have to go back and look that up and get that to you later today or on our next show. Another tweet says, as an American descendant of slavery, we are educating our older relatives about Biden's record and breaking the Obama myth, and we are not voting for him meaning Biden. Now, I don't want to make this like a pile-on on Biden from, you know, different people's perspectives, but about Obama, you wrote an article about the ironic necessity for the biggest liberals in the Democratic race to criticize not just Biden, but also President Obama. Can you lay that out for us?
Yes. So Biden criticized his opponents following the debate about how often they criticized the Obama administration. He said the way the Democrats need to win is by focusing on Trump. Well, my argument is that many of the candidates running for the Democratic nomination are criticizing the Obama administration because that is the way they can best criticize Biden. Biden constantly points to the Obama administration as proof for why he believes he is the best candidate for the job. And so if you listen, they weren't picking apart President Obama specifically. They were picking apart the policies related to immigration issues and some other factors that Biden was taking credit for. And that's what is common in a debate. You saw it with the other candidates. You're picking apart one another's records. And so if Biden's going to continue to point to his work in the Obama administration, he should expect his opponents to continue to pick that work apart.
One more call. Alan in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Alan.
Good morning. The speakerphone. I was going to make the comment that we should be very careful about adopting the vocabulary of our opponents, just as when they invented the term death tax to talk about estate tax, or pro-life to talk about being anti-abortion. Those are terms that are liked by their supporters. So whenever we criticize their policies using their words and calling ourselves opponents of white supremacy, the white supremacists in the audience like the term white supremacy. So we, in effect, do his job for him by making him their followers believe that he's doing what he's claiming to do. What all he's really doing is selling fool's gold or dividing people or advertising an elixir or the tooth fairy. And we should really focus on what it is about these people that makes them more akin to the victims of drug kingpins instead of being drug kingpins themselves. That was a big mistake of Hillary using the phrase basket of deplorables to tie Trump to his audience instead of separating them and saying these people don't realize how they are being used as tools and they're being exploited to distract them from the interests they really have economically.
So you're afraid, I'm just going to jump in for time, that you're afraid that by Biden giving that speech yesterday and maybe going forward other days, using the term white supremacy repeatedly, that it legitimizes or helps to actually spread the explicit embrace of white supremacy by people around the country?
I'm totally in favor of the substance of what Biden's trying to do. I would just say let's try to avoid using their territory, their terminology, and use terminology to talk about what we're against that doesn't make the audience feel that we're validating the product that Trump is selling. He's not selling white supremacy. What he's selling is distraction from economic hardship that Republican policies are causing. That's kind of a Bernie Sanders line, and I think more of the Democrats should adopt that, whether they want to go as far to the left in policies as he wants to. And Democrats usually don't go that way. I think maybe they should do that to separate the audience from the speaker.
Interesting. Alan, thank you very much. So as a last thought from you, Eugene, do you think that there's political risk in Biden or any other Democratic presidential hopeful using the term white supremacy, either in the way that Alan was describing or in alienating a lot of white suburban swing voters who were so important to the Democrats taking the House last year and, you know, as they look forward to trying to defeat Trump in 2020?
I think each time Biden speaks out against racism and the prevalence of it and Trump's role in it and perhaps Trump supporters' role in it, he is at risk of losing the support of some previous Trump supporters who are looking for an alternative to the president. But the reality is that Biden is running for the Democratic nomination, and the most faithful voting bloc in the Democratic nomination, it's black voters. And so if Biden wants to win this nomination, I would imagine that he would need to be more concerned about the issues that matter most to black voters than white working class voters who voted for Trump in 2016. It's going to be a hard balance, but I think it's possible. But the reality is, at the end of the day, racism is a real problem. And whoever wins the Democratic nomination or wants the Democratic nomination is going to have to speak out against it boldly.
Eugene Scott writes for The Washington Post's politics blog, The Fix. Eugene, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Former New York City Police Commissioner William Bratton next. Stay with us.